thanks for coming out at this late hour. I know it is tough to hear more readings at this time. I was here 5 years ago as a contributor in Michael's workshop, and we workshopped many of the poems that became this book, so it's really exciting to be back and reading from it today. And thank you, Michael, for your kindness. I'm going to start by reading the title poem, and then maybe I'll say a little bit more before getting into the collection. Temper. Some things are damned to erupt like wildfire, windblown like wild lupin, like wings, one after another, leaving the stone hole in the greenhouse glass. Peak bloom, a brood of blue before a firebrand. And though it is late in the season, the bathers also obey. One after another, they breathe in and butterfly the surface, mimic white, harvester, spot-celled sister, fed by the spring, the water beneath is cold. The title of the next poem grows out of my obsession with thinking about interior design of temporary space. So I read a lot about like elevator design, and I actually have a favorite kind of elevator, which doesn't have any doors, and it moves on a continuous loop with compartments that are just big enough for two people. So it sort of feeds my notions of intimate space and repetition. It's called a paternoster, which is the word for the start of the Lord's Prayer, Our Father. And it's also a kind of fishing rig that has many hooks. And the word patter, you know, for the stuff that we say in between our poems, comes from the word paternoster. It means to mouth things rather than give them meaning. It's a form of illusion and hypnosis. So picture the continuous loop. And if I snap my fingers at the end of the reading, beware. Paternoster. The word for a line with a series of hooks also means the recitation of a prayer. But in our case, a paternoster is shaped by the weight it holds at its end. The leader and the link are determined by the shyness of the bite. Reeling it toward you peaks the bait. Move closer. I want to tell you a story. It has its blood knots, its changing water, the usual lures. Family, violence, a margin left bare for interpretive remark. It's not easy, even with this sinker, to go below the surface, to ask you to offer me your open throat. I'll start with a thing dragged up, the body of my sister. I'll give you the location, the tracks, the red treble designed to mock blood, to stick into the skin, one suspect, our father. Put this begging in your mouth, a decade of loaded beads. First mystery of my father. Yes, my father wanted to become a priest, then met my mother, the story goes. I say this because it is my nature to deceive you, to pull on colors experience deems poison, to keep you from tasting my skin. He left seminary for the army years before they met, which puts him in Germany transcribing cipher, tuning his ear to the radio traffic. It is here that I lose him, long before I am born. Think of Eve. She saw her father naked and felt ashamed. Second mystery of my father. This is the big one, the book that weighs on my father's lap. He's wrapped in a blanket, flannel, scarf. It's December inside our house. Behind the walls, the hot water in the pipes clots. This is his Sunday ritual, highlighting the passages about redemption. The pages are yellow. Words rise as though spoken, boiled. This one's called Second Mystery of My Sister, so you can kind of get the sense of this continual loop thing that I'm working with. But the cool thing, another cool thing about the Paternoster elevator is that the only way off is to jump. Second Mystery of My Sister. It's impossible to define force, but it's not hard to figure the size of an arrow drawn in a diagram of the free body. Blunt, entry. These cannot be measured like the integrity of a wing. If you think of a torso as a box, you can see how someone might want to open it with his fingers. Heaven. Some would call this heaven. A teenage girl, half naked, in the grass. For all I know, they might be right. The lighting is soft, mid-morning, hazy enough to blur the details so we can fill them in any way we like. Say, a brunette, barely legal, hidden. From here, it looks like she's speechless. The other meaning of the word patter, as you of course know, is a series of taps. So it always makes me think of the first step of CPR, you know, the are you okay, the tapping on someone's shoulder. So this is a poem about breath, which is one of my other obsessions. Breathing doesn't always come naturally. And it's called Erato. She's the muse of lyric poems, of love poetry, of erotic poetry. But the muse behind this poem is really Denise Levertov and her excellent essay on breath, where she defines the root of the word muse as something like to stand open-mouthed at the foot of the temple, this really beautiful image. And I was thinking of that when I was writing this poem, and I went to look up muse, and what I found was a very different root, which was like a dog, to sniff about, tracking a scent, which seemed like kind of not as glamorous as what I like to think we do when we sit down to our work. So this is called, yeah, right? Erato. Because of the struggle, her arms and legs resisting, you might take one look at the shape in the snow and say, swan. Or angel, something to do with the divine, the light, always bending back. Or you might remember the way a girl's tongue raises ice or catches the root of the word muse, an open mouth, a muzzle. Mystery beneath a handprint of light. In another rendering, the repetition might add up to something other than evidence. A dog could signal devotion, one sister, the object of desire. With any luck, we would walk away with a target, a seizure, or a silver buckle. When we look up here, we do not see Orion. we see a silhouette shot full of holes. One more on sort of sound, and then two to finish out. This next one grows out of my other obsession, which is reading U.S. Army field manuals, so alongside Boy Scout manuals. And this one ends with a direct quote from the section in Appendix E on tracking, which you may or may not be familiar with, but it's a very short poem, 5 lines, and the last one is coming from the report. It's called Radio. Always assume someone is listening between lifts in the silence to discover your location and destroy it with fire. This has little to do with a painted face, unflayed skin. Over a radio, a voice travels in all directions. Report that you have seen signs of certain things, not that those things actually exist. Mystery ending with a girl in a field. You've heard it before, but listen. I brought you into this world. I can take you out of it. I know what you're thinking. Maybe he did. Maybe he didn't. Nothing's resolved, but what does it matter? I could snap these petals off all day, mouthing, he loves me, he loves me not. One more, and then I will snap my fingers and you will feel refreshed and rejuvenated. This one has at its heart an Andrew Marvel poem, The Nymph Lamenting the Death of Her Fawn, which has this like crazy line in it, "Oh, I cannot be unkind to a beast that loveth me." It's called Elegy. No shepherds, no nymphs, maybe just one. The girl the fawn strips like a fisherman's rose. Death turns its mouth red. It can no longer lie in the lilies, not on my watch. The lake is filthy with silverfish, sticky with leeches. Lovesick, I flick a feather into the water. No stones, only the one in my pocket, heavy as a tongue.
Oh, I didn't see you there. what? Sorry. In my way in here, I was running through the kitchen. I broke the clock. So someone bill me for that. But it's fitting because we're going to do things with time. I want to thank Michael, Jen, and Noreen for sneaking me in the back door. And the various people here who are whose sleep deprivation seems to be running this place, staffs of all kinds, including Gerald Ma and Michael Peterson, who have helped me in ways you will soon find out. My name's Ken Chen. It rhymes. This is my book, Juvenalia. And I've been told that it's a really good book to read if you've recently had a breakup. So something to keep in mind while you're here. And it's also a very good book to read if your parents have had a breakup. So I think what we'll do is we'll start with our current breakups, and then we will recede backwards in time and blame it on our parents, as often happens. This first poem is This first thing is incited poem. This first poem is... is inspired by one of the most important, well-read, influential literary texts right now, by which I mean the LSAT. It's also influenced by this line from Li He that made me realize how logic can be kind, or thinking can be kind of musical. It's something like, if the gods too had passions, then they would also age. I can bask in his. Like the LSAT, this piece has a series of questions, and there are answers to the questions. But if you're in a hurry, all of the answers are in the title of the poem. So if you remember the title, then you will be omniscient. Okay, the title is Yes, No, Yes, The Future, Gone, Happy, Yes, No, Yes, Cut, You. So I hope you got that. The first sentence of this poem is not about you. In this respect, it is unlike the last sentence and my heart. Is the heart a thing that can be about something? We were about to break up, and after that, we broke up. Did it have to end in this? I mean, was there anything else I could have done? See fifth to last sentence. When dinner wilts into memory, when the frost fluorescent bars and parking lots spangle out like bones blooming from a tree, when I busy myself out towards sleep, wheel around, adorned in by alone from every direction, when the moon outdopples the ambulance siren and the evening pollutes itself with reference, suffused by our lost, elbow clasping, smoky tender, moist and utmost, shirtless, plucked up, naked nights. When I miss you, does that make the first sentence false? Because I think about you more now that my life no longer mentions you. If statement is when antecedent and consequent clap their hands, having thought for a while, having understood what we have built behind us, let me ask, what is the wilderness charring the scene before me? It is called the future, the branches feathery and lowing in the wind. Now, call the consequent a painting. Why don't I see you in this painting? Now that you are no longer here, a scar floats as halo above my scalp, and when you come back, I grow jealous of your talents. What are my talents? You're so good at being happy, a skill I too practice, or try to practice, and despise. Well, don't worry. I've been to the future. I've seen that scar evaporate into a crown. Will you call me in September? The conversation was boring. Fat pauses like lakes. I didn't know what to say. Did I want to hang up? No. Never. I must have loved you. Are questions like relationships? Questions have answers, unless they are questions 9 or 2. What are questions for? One can use a question mark for many things. For example, as a sickle for cutting people's hearts off. How can you cut someone off with a question? You know, like when I said, yeah, but we're still in love with each other, right? And you told me the answer. Okay. So imagine if you, in life, if there's a civil war. The war was bad, so you ran away from this country. You ran to an island. You were worried that the people who won the civil war here were going to take over that island. So you ran from that island to another country. And then you had children at the island, and they had children in this country. That is a way of describing what my grandparents and parents went through. My grandparents were Chinese. My parents were born in Taiwan, and I was born here. So they have this whole history, and I think what's important is that it's actually has nothing to do with me. It's like not my story. Chinese is much worse than many people here. I know I'm close enough to the context where I can see that a world exists there, but it's not really my world. So I don't think I'm very good at depicting what that world looks like, but I think I can depict that there's a context there that I don't understand. So I've tried to write something that depicts that kind of opacity, and I've tried to write as boring, unemotionally, and awkwardly as possible. One part of being the children of immigrants, or maybe the children of anyone, is that your parents' world is a sort of vanished world, and you know that you can supply these little words, like appositives, to clarify the context. So an appositive is like, you know, usually you have a noun, comma, blah, blah, blah. So like Beth Bachman, comma, lover of elevators, you know. So this grammatical thing gives you the background. It fills in the context, reduces the opacity, and makes things knowable. So I have a thing about all of that stuff. There's a lot of stuff here. So the last third of my book, I plagiarized from Wikipedia. I talk about appositives, this thing I just talked about. I plagiarized from Herbert Giles, who was a famous Canadian sinologist, and he would write footnotes to the stuff that he did, including this book of ghost stories. And the footnotes would talk about random things, like cooking instructions, like how the recipes in the poems. And while I was doing this, I was translating with my mother the poems of this guy named Li Yu, who is sort of like not really translated, but based on what I can tell from conversations with my mother, he's the hottest poet in Chinese literary history. And he was sort of a romantic, but then he was a king. And then the king of the neighboring place took over his place, and his wife died. So he became a different type of poet, a poet who wrote about being in exile. So this poem is kind of a blender of all these things, and it will be a little unusual. I'll be right back. So the title of this poem is The Invisible Memoir.
Mother's father and mother.
Father's mother and father.
Mother and father.
Sister.
The tears of Chinese mermaids are said to be pearls.
I think their coming here affect our marriage.
My mother and I are sitting in a cafe in Cupertino eating baobing.
If Li Yu had put into governing his state the effort that he put into composing poetry, he would never have become my prisoner.
Alternately referred to as Beautiful Island, Northern Outpost, in the Gates of Hell.
Dad and the two house guests.
I sit with my sister on my grandmother's couch, where we stare at the coffee table and chew dried sour plums and wafers of Chinese candy like a pink roll of pennies. My mother would measure our height against our grandmother, who with her husband had fled Beijing for Taipei and then San Jose after my parents had settled in California. When my mother was homesick, she thought of Taiwan, unlike her mother, who thought of China. My mother had acquired a patience that wanted nothing, a sort of contented despair. Because she and my mother were Christian, they did not celebrate holidays such as the Ghost Month, when the gates of hell are said to open.
The great sorrow of decapitation, as opposed to strangulation, is that the body will appear in the realms below without a head. The family of any condemned man who may have sufficient means will always bribe the executioner to sew it on again.
I didn't know you lived with her parents.
I did.
We invented ghosts to hide the thing from its definition.
We missed the thing, which was not lovable. He was stingy and spoke a Mandarin that smelled like nicotine. Who gave us candy when we sat on her couch. Who worked as a statistician when he was in Beijing. But the thing itself no longer exists.
Tomorrow, my mother will be dead.
wrote Jules Janard in 1900.
I shall know another ghost.
Pu Song Ling, the author of the Ming Dynasty classic, Lao Zai Ziyi.
Strange Tales from a Chinese Studio.
Describes a man named Su, who carries the ghost of his true love and finds her.
So light that she is like carrying a child.
When translator Herbert Giles compares this
to the German notion that the spirit of the dead mother coming back at night to suckle the child she has left behind makes an impress on the bed alongside the baby.
We may argue that he divulges in a positive desire, the desire to contextualize. While Giles aims only to renovate the scope of the sentence, widening his focus from a Chinese romance to a nursing mother in Germany. It also seems accurate to say that he describes the weight of the past as it hangs behind each object, thick and transparent. The appositive is the noun's ghost.
Father, heart attack.
Felt like someone pressing their palm on my chest.
Friend said, it'll go away.
We should just pray.
I try to speak.
Don't try too hard. We know all about your limitations.
Yeah, you have a big mouth.
Sit down and pray.
Frequently occurring words in Li Yu.
Spring.
27.
One. Blossom. Dream. Not.
20.
Wind. Moon.
18.
Person.
10.
No words my own, nothing to say, climbing alone the western chamber, the moon bent like a hook. Lonely under the sycamores, all autumn locked in. Cannot cut it cleanly off or even order it without the mess. This is the sorrow of leaving, no other taste in my heart.
Which, well cooked, are a very good substitute for asparagus.
I think we become adults when we cannot explain our life to anyone without using appositives.
All I want is to tell you stories about my life.
For each new friend we make, the past becomes an unintended secret. An invisible hallway unfolds behind each friend's body, hidden from view by that friend's newness. It makes me lonely. So I want to thank Elizabeth Graham and Tiffany Unique. I just have one more thing, and you won't have to bother with me. There's a character in this poem who makes a kind of cameo appearance, who's Wang Wei, who's sort of in the greatest hits list of Chinese literature. He was actually a prime minister in the government, but like many of these poets, he was sort of a hippie. So he quit and left the life of government, which is sort of the dream job, and went to live in the forest. He usually gets translated like a pastoral poet, but I think he's more like Beckett or something, or Dickinson. There's something very strange. The title is My Father and My Mother Decide My Future. And how could we forget Wang Wei? The suitcase open on the bed. My grandfather is packing up his organs. When he is done, he takes a taxi to my grandmother's house for supper. Exits the empty car to Taipei Alley. Dissolve. Now the Los Altos lot. So, did you listen to him? My father says, taking the keys out of the ignition. You should become a lawyer, but your grandfather says anything is fine as long as you are the best. My father stays. My mother stays silent. I sit and suck my thumb. I saw your painting. It was beautiful, my mother says to Wang Wei, restrained beside me by backseat belt and streetlight world. Wang Wei, who says, in the silent bamboo woods, sitting along, playing strings and bellowing long. But America is allergic to bamboo, my father says to Wang Wei. They love skill sets, cash, and the first person singular. The language of C++, not our English. Steps out, shuts the door, puts gas pump by Acura trunk. My father's son does not understand, forgets the Chinese he never remembered. But my mother holds words in her mouth. The Peking opera soundtrack of my childhood. You sound like it. I'd listen to it on the radio, you know, when I had to sweep the floor. And then Wang Wei. Nobody knows but the deep grove and the luminous moon that glows in response. California moon not glow, or as the translation might say, irradiates instead like beige screen before my mother, now at HP, after Taipei and degree in home ec, and divorce. My mother like the moon, which rents light from its past. My mother who says, looking at the dashboard, you should listen to your father. I don't know. Here he comes. My father unlocks a door and says, drop the keys in the toilet. But that's what life is like. You're young, my father says. I'm not sure to me or Wang Wei. You don't understand the world which loves those who enter it. And then Wang Wei. Red hearts in the southern country. Spring comes with stems enlarging. I didn't know you two were still together. We're not, my father says. He is unsentimental and gestures at the wish that furnishes the mind of his son. Your son? Asks Wang Wei. He has seen me and become real, as though a ghost could die into a man. Not the monk you quite expect. Wang Wei wears a cowboy's deadened face and stares at you, not unlike an establishing shot. He says, who are you? Like the scene in the movie where the actors find the camera and say, stop looking at me. They quit the car and stand. And I say, wish you'd gathered some. Caught me more of this thing that is longing. And Wang Wei asks, who are you? And my father says, decide. Thank you.
Thank you. So my name's Lisa Marganelli, and back in 2001, I wasn't particularly interested in oil, and now I'm going to read to you for 15 minutes about oil, but you've persisted through all of Breadloaf, and this whole thing has persisted, so you're going to last. Plus, Ken set me up perfectly because his last poem happened at a gas station. What could be better? So what happened to me was I got invited to Saddam's birthday party, which I'm not going to go into, in 2001, and then about a month later, I flew over the Alaska pipeline, and when you look down at the Alaska pipeline from an airplane, it is this beautiful, like a piece of jewelry stretching across all of Alaska, and it is like a giant straw. You will never understand the power of the American consumer more than when you're either staring at the giant straw or with your foot on the gas pedal. It's a giant straw bringing oil from the ends of the earth back to us. And basically, I set off, and over the next, between 2001 and 2007, I decided to find the stories on the other end of the pipeline. And I'm going to read you two stories, brief ones today. One is relatively funny about the people who get oil out of, sort of funny, it's not really, about the people who get oil out of the ground in Texas, and then another, heartily depressing story. So I don't want to prejudice you. So the first story begins in East Texas, in the middle of It's a boom. It's a boom, basically. There's like three rigs close together. You can chuck a rock between them. And it's very hot in East Texas. It's nighttime. It's like 100 degrees. I'm outside of a town named Dew and headed for another one named Luna. They were really small. A fuzz of halogen light appears with a tower in the middle. I break to stare. A heavy industrial exoskeleton of crossbeams and wires, the 150-foot-tall derrick has trailers gathered around its base. The business end of the rig, that chomping drill bit, is buried under the soil and out of sight. The angled legs of the derrick have an insect-like quality, as if a monster mosquito were crouching over the skin of a giant, hindquarters in the air, head buried in a vein. A second derrick appears, my cue to turn right onto the access road to a third, where I hope to find a man named C.D. Roper, who's more or less dared me to come visit him. In phone conversations, C.D. has told me he's a fourth-generation oil man tracing back to a great-granddad who is a blacksmith and part Cherokee Indian. I can't do C.D.'s accent anymore, and he died last year. I'm very sorry about this, but because it's wonderful. I had drill cuttings in my first baby rattle, he said the first time we talked. My uncle made me a rattle out of a gourd, and my grandpa decided it didn't make enough noise, so he went out and got some Austin chalk cuttings and put them in there. Austin chalk is the name of a notorious limestone rock layer in East Texas. A well in Austin chalk will appear to produce lots of oil for a day or a week, but quickly peters out. A sucker's play, C.D. called it. My grandpa figured if I got close to Austin chalk with that rattle, then I wouldn't need to touch the stuff later on. People have lost their ass in chalk. Did he lose his ass in chalk anyway, I asked. Yes, I did. I lost my shirt, and I wasn't even spending. C.D. had a deep Texan drawl that sometimes crumbled like something that had been dipped in batter and fried too long. I've lost $200,000 so many times it seems reasonable, he said. People who love oil, particularly Texans with romantic feelings for the stuff, often say they enjoy the smell of petroleum. C.D. belongs in this category. I was like a well-trained ranch dog, he said one night. Whenever my dad and grandpa were going out to visit a rig, I'd sneak in the car. I loved the sound of the drilling rig, the smells. From that elemental obsession, he spent his life in every facet of the oil business, from directional drilling to geological analysis, negotiating property rights, blah, blah, blah. I love the process of getting it out of the ground. People think there's big caverns of oil and you just stick a straw in him, but it's really more like a sponge. At the end of the road stands the derrick. I enter the square garrison of trailers around its base, park, and open my car door to a stunning wall of 100-degree heat and throbbing noise. Ka-chunk, ka-chunk. By the time I stand up, this sound has seeped into pounding vibrations beyond my hearing. I feel seasick. The derrick has another white trailer lodged partway up it, as if a child had jammed a toy in the rigging before heading off to supper. And on the ground below, it is bright as day if daylight were green and the shadows have thin green rinds. When I look down, my feet appear foggy, as if I'm watching them on a staticky TV screen. Leaning over to get a better look, I discover a flat mass of brown insects hopping in unison 3 inches off the ground. This is all a little more Alice in Wonderland than I had expected. An old luxury car sits next to me, not a Cadillac, but a Chrysler Fifth Avenue, with its hood up and a hatchet resting on the engine block. Who uses a hatchet to fix a car? And another thought, more alarming, will I need this hatchet later? Perhaps this is a video game where the object is to collect weapons and tools as you go along. Then I high-step through the bugs towards the trailer labeled mudlogging. The door of the trailer opens and a small grayish man looks at me with hostility. I yell that I'm looking for C.D. Roper. He's not here, says the man, setting his mouth in a line that turns down at the ends. He wears wire bifocals that magnify his eyes, so he looks like a belligerent bulldog. Frozen air curls out of the trailer. The bulldog turns away and gestures me inside disinterestedly. And when the door wuffs shut, the trailer is immediately cold and almost quiet. In place of grasshoppers, there is a highly polished, even lustrous, linoleum floor. And with his back still turned, the man motions to a booth with screwed down benches, saying, "Pull up a seat." I choose to interpret this as irony, or perhaps a friendly joke. I wonder if I should say something positive about the extractive industries. Texans can be very defensive about oil because they assume the rest of the country does not approve. They produce probably a third of our oil off of the Gulf, and they refine about half of our gasoline. And they're kind of touchy about it. I'm sort of wondering if CD isn't going to show up. I'm skipping ahead a little bit here. The bulldog's back is towards me. "Where's CD?" I ask, thinking I'd better get it over with if he stood me up. "I am him," the bulldog says, folding himself double, slapping his knee and cackling. And then I recognize his voice, all the crackly bits falling off the sides. His face crinkles and he hops around the trailer, slapping himself with glee. Of course the hatchet in the car is his. So's the floor wax. He's delighted by my shock. "You look like a possum been eating a persimmon." But he still wasn't going to take me off up onto the rig. First of all, he hands me a hard hat. He tells me to turn my car around. What that's all about is every gas rig or oil rig can blow up, as you know, if you've seen the Deepwater Horizon disaster. If you hit a pocket of gas, you can send the drill pipe up into the air like spaghetti, they say, and it comes on down. And then if that gas lights on fire, then you have like this giant jet shooting out of the ground. And so what they do on the oil rig is they tell you to turn your car around so that in case it happens, you can go get in your car and, you know, leave. But you don't have to turn around. I love that. I mean, I think that's very typical of the oil industry. It's this kind of wild optimism and a lot of safety measures. And then these like weird, almost superstitious things. Anyway, when I come back into the trailer, the drill bit is precisely 10,028 feet below us, crunching downward at a rate of 23 feet per hour. CD's official job on this rig is a mud logger, which means he creates a record of the progress of the bit through the rock layers below, so he kind of knows it like it's his own backyard. In front of him is a chart showing the rock layers in this part of Texas. The names are reminiscent of suburban cul-de-sacs: Pecan Gap Chalk, Blossom Sand, Glen Rose, Rodessa, James Lime, Travis Peak. CD treats these layers as a sort of neighborhood with a lot of familiarity and an affection. "I think there's a pool of primordial knowledge, and some people stick a straw in it," he says later that night as he does a calculation. "I'm into the numbers. Numbers are the way to understand the oil fields." Nothing makes him happier than calculating accurately where one layer leaves off and another begins. And CD, though, is never just happy. He's usually happier than a three-nutted tomcat. I'd like to tell you more about the formation of oil and phytoplankton and three-foot starfish and all that sort of stuff, but I'm actually going to skip a little bit. One of the things about CD is that he's part of this sort of oil fraternity that understands the underground almost like it's real today. He used to ride across Texas with his grandpa, and his grandpa would act out the Cretaceous Sea that they were driving across, because all of Texas was a sea with a giant llano uplift, this big red mountain in the middle of it. And his grandpa would narrate the whole trip as though they were in the Cretaceous landscape, which to me is wild. And it gives you a sense of how people who extract oil are actually a little different than us in significant ways that don't have to do with environmentalism. Anyway, we have a moment where CD's actually still, I mean, it's a couple hours in, and he's still not taking me up to the rig. So I'm still wondering what's going on. He's not shy, but he's not really at ease either, and he's not ready to take me up on the rig, so I keep my notebook closed, and we talk for a few hours until things feel a little bit normal. And somehow we end up talking about sheep. And CD and I both tended flocks of sheep as kids. Like me, he raised some lambs with bottled milk, which turned the lamb into sort of a woolly family member, a sheep person or a per sheep, whose emotional depth is hard for non-shepherds to grasp. If you're a lonely farm kid, a sheep can provide a great deal of non-judgmental empathy. Sheep really know how to listen. But honestly, CD and I are both unreformed sheep-loving nerds. And his pet lamb was named Rainbow, and sometime around midnight, he begins to cry at the thought of the cruel uncle who killed Rainbow and ate him. CD first tries to wipe the tears from under his glasses and finally takes off the glasses and stands under the fluorescent lights, looking very, very gray. He puts his glasses back on and snorts, regaining the Texas macho thing. "I honestly thought about poisoning that son of a bitch," he says of his uncle. And I think then that he's shockingly brave, but he really prefers bravado. In any case, things suddenly feel normal enough to go up to the rig. So CD leads me out of the trailer and past the three diesel locomotive engines that send power to the drill, past the red blowout protectors, you've heard a lot about those in the past couple months, and we head up the stairs leading to the rig. There's an oil industry expression, live by the drill bit, which means that the only real measure of a project's worth is the oil or gas that gets found. Intentions, promotions, hopes, and personalities fade in front of the mighty drill bit. From the drill bit, America stretches out like a Rube Goldberg machine. Here is the bit that gets the gas that produces the electricity that powers the factory that builds the trucks that burn the diesel that... In this context, climbing the stairs to the doghouse has some aspects of religious pilgrimage, upward to the drill bit, upward to the truth, and on the other hand, the engine racket is so powerful the staircase shakes, the air has been supplanted by tangy diesel exhaust, and any sensible creature who isn't getting at least 13.25 an hour has long since left the vicinity. And now I'm just going to read a little bit about Venezuela, and you can go to dinner. Lake Maracaibo is the source of Venezuela's wealth, is a great gray plate, 40 miles long, home to more than 37,000 miles of underwater pipelines dating back to the 1920s. Maracaibo is not a lake in the conventional sense, with kids in bathing suits and beach balls and pleasure boats. Better to use the word facility to describe its bristle of electrical lines, oil platforms, strangely human silhouettes of pipe, and otherworldly outlines of collection stations gleaming through the mist. There's something mysterious about the perspective on the lake. These installations look like bathtub toys as you approach until all of a sudden, without any transition, they loom overhead. One of the tricks of perspective that's happening in Venezuela is that among his other projects, Chavez is trying to make a $41 billion oil company the leader of a people's revolution, which is a pretty complex act when you really think about it. A professor named Jorge, who had been studying the people around the lake, took me. He picks me up in a massive green Impala. And many miles from Maracaibo, he pulls off the road into the scrub towards a petrochemical plant called El Tablazo. The Impala winds into the sand, jouncing around the hill past the no-entry sign until we're facing the ruins of a small town studded among tall brush. A flare roars overhead, burning the gases from the plant and filling the scrub with an enormous hiss. I have to lean close to Jorge so I can hear what he's saying. "When this was the village of Hornitos, they had two flares going," he yells. "Everybody here spoke by shouting. They didn't have night anymore because they always had this huge candle." He points to the flare. "The rain became acid rain, and the whole community would lose their clothes if they hung them outside to dry. Two or three times a month, a release of chlorine gas would send 1,000 people running from the village looking for air." Jorge was describing a perfect hell, a perversion of life so complete, it sounded like the plot from a novel by Gabriel Garcia Marquez. It was hard for me to imagine that these random walls had once been a village. The town smelled of sagebrush and faintly of cleaning products, as if somebody nearby were scrubbing tile. "Even now," he yells, "I can't understand why they stayed here." Hornitos was originally a fishing village on the edge of the lake. The petrochemical plant building process was started in the 1950s and continued in a mess of corruption until it was completed in the 70s. Jorge says the villagers accepted what they got, and as people began to get sick from chemical releases, they didn't complain. Even when they had spontaneous abortions, even when 8 women aborted in their 8th month, Jorge's students began surveying the village in the late 1970s, and eventually they discovered that people had hidden children with birth defects in their homes. "It was so sad that I cried," Jorge said. For years he tried to puzzle out why the villagers stayed silent. "I wondered for a long time why they didn't recognize the trend. I don't think it was lack of education or lack of understanding of cause and effect or shame. I think they didn't want to notice because they were powerless to move." This was the thing that was big in Venezuela and in all oil countries, is this external locus of control that keeps popping up. Nobody seems to control their own destiny. Now Jorge wonders if all Venezuelans aren't somehow in the village, trapped under the big specter of oil. PDVSA, which is the oil company, is the main patron of this country, and our whole modern history is oil, he says as we drive back towards Maracaibo. PDVSA rules Venezuela, and in his view, the state has always seen itself as the ideological appendage of the oil company, smoothing things over, making sure that the one true business of this country continues at any cost. PDVSA is the power. Whatever is economic, strategic, or political, it has to do. The old PDVSA and the new are all too similar. When the villagers of Hornitos finally protested in 1992, it was like a 25-year organizing effort. The military threatened to try them for treason because they were endangering the economy and national security. Jorge went to jail. Though Chavez's government has done a much better job of distributing the oil wealth to the poor, it has not abandoned the idea of traitors. In 2004, government officials accused environmentalists of being a green mafia supported by international oil companies and the CIA. An indigenous activist against coal mines has been called a terrorist, and around the lake, newly empowered Chavista Bolivarians invoke the Constitution and the Bible, but they cannot question the primacy of oil. And so La Lucha, Chavez's big struggle, goes on and on. That's it. Thank you very much.